Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode. This event was proudly supported by ARA Group. It was also supported through the Melbourne City Revitalisation Fund, a $200 million partnership of the Victorian Government and the City of Melbourne.
So I'll just fill you in a bit why I'm here speaking with Sam. Actually, I don't know, but Sam, you'll explain probably. But we've known each other for... I don't know if that's the... Oh, that's the time we did an ad together, isn't it? There we go. That was taken 30 years ago, something like that, at a... It was the Fox Studios opening, which was a very big deal, wasn't it?
It was.
Time to have studio, and you've probably worked there over the years, have you?
I have.
We have been friends because we made a film together, which we'll discuss and talk about later. I wasn't in it, but Sam was in it, called The Dish. But one thing that we had is that Sam has kept up friendship with not only myself, but many people, as if you've read the book. You would notice all the friendships and the warmth and love and respect he has for so many people, and it works both ways, of course. So we'll get into some of those friendships as we go through today as well. What I want to show here, this is young Sam.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise known as, in his home of New Zealand, as Huckleberry Fun.
Yeah, that's at Lake Sumner, and I was lucky to grow up with parents who loved the outdoors. We never had a holiday place we went to. We'd always go camping, and I was taught to fish, and I grew to particularly love the mountains of New Zealand. We moved out there when I was 7 years old. And that's still my sort of go-to dreamland, and ultimately, one of the lucky things that happened to me was that my career allowed me to build things, and I now live up in the mountains of New Zealand. I have a farm there and make wine there. But this is early days. Probably, you know, I'm probably 7 years old and trying to catch a trout, and I did catch trout once in a while. My mother, who was like a lot of women of her generation, would defer to my father, but was much better than Dad at most things, including fishing. And she'd always catch about five fish to his one. And she was a much better horsewoman as well, but we might get to that.
Well, here we have your father, a military man. You came from, or he was in a, was your family always involved in the military?
There's a lot of military on both sides, most particularly my mother's side. And, you know, Mum always used to say, a soldier's daughter never cries, and I never saw Mum cry.
Oh, really?
And, you know, her father was killed in the First War, and, you know, there's just lots of military on both sides. But my father was in the army. He was in the Irish Fusiliers. And that horse is a stolen horse. because they were in the occupying forces in Trieste at the end of the war, and my mother and my brother, who was 5 years old, they went to join Dad, and they had a year in Trieste, keeping what would become the Yugoslavians and the, you know, bandits and so on, and the fascists in Italy from killing each other. The sort of thing that happens at the end of wars. Anyway, Dad was a very keen equestrian all his life. Mum was quietly better than him again at that. But that horse, they didn't have a lot to do, to be honest, for that year, except conceive me.
I'm curious to know where that happened.
Yes, I asked myself, and it was in Venice, you know.
That's
at the Hotel Danielli, which is the best hotel. Yeah. Of course, it had to be the best.
It had to be.
But how they afforded that, I'm not sure. No, we never had any money. So there must have been some sort of discount for the forces. But Dad said it was one wet afternoon in Venice. And it was me. But anyway, he purloined a huge old ambulance from Trieste, and because he had word that an Austrian cavalry regiment was disbanding up in Vienna, and he drove through the mountains, took two wonderful horses. That's one of them. And Mum and Dad had a great time, event riding and hunting and all that sort of thing. And I really rather love that picture because it's, you know, horse and rider both enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
And that's the best thing about equestrianism, really, is when a horse isn't enjoying himself as much as the rider. And Dad, his last 20 years, he became obsessed by dressage, sort of ridiculous. It's the sort of ridiculous end of horsemanship.
Well, would he have been impressed? Here he is showing the Queen.
Oh, yeah.
This is a fascinating picture to me. It's amazing.
Yeah, this is not long after the coronation, the last previous coronation, which is an awfully long time ago. And the grumpy-looking woman in the middle is the Queen. And that's my father with the sword beside her. And they're all in their dress uniform.
Mm.
And behind the Queen is Group Captain Peter Townsend. If any of you have watched The Crown, you will know that he was, shall we say, compromising Princess Margaret at the time. And that's probably why the Queen is looking back. She wants to strangle the man behind her.
It's an extraordinary picture, Sam. And your father, again, having been in the military when he left, how did he behave at home? What was his style with you and your family members?
Well, Mum was very English, and Dad was a New Zealander, but he was, you know, to all intents and purposes, you know, a military Englishman. And he was sent to boarding school in England when he was 12 years old or something, and didn't see his parents for 5 years. I'm ridiculous. And he was Sandhurst and Harrow and all that stuff. So, and I adored my father, but he was a very sort of formal man. When I'd go to boarding school, even when I went to bed, we'd shake hands. Good night, old chap. We'd shake hands.
You weren't a very tactile family, is that right?
No, there's no hugging or anything like that. And I don't remember anyone ever saying, I love you. It's obligatory in families now. You have to say that sort of three times a day, otherwise.
It's very woke.
Otherwise your children get insecure or something. But I've never felt the necessity to do so. I do because I feel pressured by them to. I love you too, you know. But, I do remember Dad was... By the way, the title of the book is "Did I Ever Tell You This?" And it occurred to me that it was actually David Marr that suggested the title, because we were having a chat and I was telling stories, and he said, "Oh, stop! That's your title. Did I ever tell you this?" But it's also there's a sort of insecurity in that title, because while I like telling stories, and the book was about stories. My terrible fear is that I'll tell a story twice. So if I tell any stories today, it's because they're not in the book.
We don't mind, Sam. It's all right.
But Dad, speaking about saying good night to Dad, I remember very vividly a night when my dear old father, because I'd say, good night, Dad, and good night, old chap. And then it was a night before going off on the train to college. So I was 13 years old. And Dad came up to say good night. And I was thinking, what's Dad doing up here?
Was that unheard of, was it?
He never did that in his life, you know. Close the door behind you. You know, and anyway, there was Dad, and he came into the room like this, you know. I said, "Hello, Dad." He said, "Yes, all right, old chap. so off to school tomorrow." And I said, "Yeah, that's right, Dad. Yeah. Yes. Well, Nandok, your old headmaster, did he ever talk to you about other boys?" And so,
what's he doing?
I think I know what he might be on about. I said, "Yes, Dad, he did." He said, "Oh, good, good. All right, all right. Good. All right. Well, good night, and sleep well."
Was it left to your poor mum to have to do some explaining?
That was the only sort of facts of life thing I ever got from Dad. But I did get something almost about the same time. Some of you might be old enough to remember a book called Patent Place, which is very important when people my age, because it had one or two sort of risque bits in it. Page 67, I think, was it.
We had an equivalent to that. It was The Thornbirds.
The Thornbirds?
Yes, and there was a few pages that, yes, we used to bookmark in that.
Yeah, well, you didn't have to mark it. You could see it when it was closed.
I was a little crumpled.
Yeah, but I would have it sort of under my mattress so I could check it up. And when I went to check it, and the thorn, you know, the patent place was missing. And I thought, oh, my God, I've been busted. My mother has found page 67. I'll never see that again. And, but nothing was said, you know, we never mentioned things like that. The next night I went to bed and there was a book there. And I went, I put it out, and it was the Department of Health Guide to Adolescents and Facts of Life. I was so embarrassed. Oh, and I put it back under there. Again, nothing was mentioned. But no, those were the only times I got any guidance from my parents about what was to come.
I guess you must have found some things out at boarding school or not, and I'm not implying anything happened weird at boarding school. Right. What I mean is that when you're at boarding school, you're away from your parents and it's difficult when you're young. Is that when you became involved in plays and theatre as an outlet? Were you a sporty guy? Were you?
No. I was completely hopeless in sport and still am. And I had a very brainy older brother. I still have this, you know, brainy older
brother. How annoying for you.
It's very irritating. He's a Shakespeare scholar and things, you know. But I got some good reviews for the book yesterday. I sent it to him just to irritate him, you know. Because I spent my whole life trying to impress my brother. And now that I've written something and he's been writing things all his life, and I got good reviews, I thought, bugger it. He's going to have to suffer that. But no, what was the?
It was getting involved and just starting.
Oh, yeah.
When does the actor Sam start to emerge?
Well, first of all, you could act at school. There'd be two or three productions a year. And I would put my hand up there, having seen my brother in school productions and acting at university and things, and thinking, that looks fun. I think I'd like to have a crack at that myself. and found it was something I enjoyed and I was, you know, halfway good at. And but the great bonus going to an all boys school was that one production a year we did with real live girls, St Margaret's College down the road, and so there wasn't no way I was going to miss out on that.
No, that's always a bonus.
Yeah,
who enjoy that? At the time when you left school, was there acting schools to go to like there are today?
No, and one of the things I talk about extensively in the book is that because I come from a small place in New Zealand, and because there was very little theatre, there was no cinema being made in New Zealand, there was very little television. We didn't even have television when I was a kid. The idea of becoming an actor, of making a living as an actor, but ultimately becoming a screen actor was just beyond my imagination, and you know, the most unlikely thing possible. So, but it did happen, so the book sort of delineates those sort of accidents that happened along the way that made that possible.
I'm going to get to your film career.
All right. You must.
If I must. But this is, I think, when most of us, if you're all Australian, remember Sam in this wonderful role in My Brilliant Career. There you are on a horse too, which is
right.
Handy.
Yeah. Yeah. This was a horse from Victoria and half mad.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And although I grew up in a very horsey family, I wasn't really interested in pursuing it. So I had to learn how to ride for my very career. And we had a wrangler who never really wrangled before, and who brought a horse for me that had never been in a film before, and also could only sort of turn left. Because that's the way that they race in Victoria.
Oh, yes. and working with Gillian Armstrong, she had spotted you in a film that you'd made in New Zealand. That was your first film that you had ever made. Mm. What was it like? Was this sort of, which was, again, a movie that you made where you were doing all your own stunts and things like this. Was this like being your first time being on a real set where you thought, I like this industry and I like being an actor? Did it hit you then?
Look, I got offered this part in a film called Sleeping Dogs, which, you know, I'm still baffled as to why they asked me to be the lead in a film. No one had made a film in New Zealand for 20 years or something. And so no one had an experience about how to act in a film, let alone be the lead in a film, and I found myself with the job. But, you know, and I wasn't too good in it, but I gave it a crack. But that film brought me to Melbourne, and it got into the film festival here, and I'd never been to Australia before, and we had an afternoon with a publicist in Melbourne, a city I'd never been in before, and they called a press conference, and only one journalist turn up for this press conference. And he'd made a mistake. He was a sports reporter. So it wasn't a very auspicious start for things for me to say. But then I caught that wonderful night train that used to go from Melbourne to Sydney. And I found myself in Sydney auditioning for this film. And that sort of changed everything for me. Not the least that it's brought me back to Melbourne so many times. I've done a lot of work here, and I'm very fond of Melbourne. I don't like the weather awfully much, but
we haven't really helped that today, have we? I don't know. It bothers you,
I keep coming back here. I'm fond of it.
I'm going to another film that you'll all be familiar with, which was a wonderful film that you were able to shoot in your beloved New Zealand. and again work with, and I say another female director, who happens to be a director, and this was The Piano. And I think as a film, it was so strikingly different for us to enjoy and watch. But I believe that when you were making it, it was a difficult time to make. It was quite a lonely time for you.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I love about my job is I absolutely love other actors. They're the best company. They're usually very smart people and funny, and you form a sort of companionship on every job that you do. This was unusual in that the other actors... Well, there was Holly, who was mute in the film, so you couldn't really talk to Holly because she was in character all the time. And then there was Harvey Keitel, who wasn't very nice and wouldn't talk to me anyway. And then there was Anna Paquin, who was 12 years old, right? You know, so you talk to a 12-year-old girl about. So I was kind of on my own. But Jane was such a warm and wonderful person that it was a great experience for me, and not the least of them being this character who's about the saddest man on the planet, and full of all sorts of demons and things, but a very complicated character. One for whom I felt sort of terribly, and on the one hand, I sort of despised him, and the other hand, I felt terribly sorry for him.
It feels so strange knowing you, and that you have such a sweetness about you, and when you play these hideous roles, for example, your character in Peaky Blinders, just the most despicable policeman of all time.
Yeah, he's...
However,
that's true.
The only redeemable thing for me was his accent.
Yeah, well, you know, I was born in Northern Ireland, but I never had that Northern Irish accent, but it is a really good one to work with. I'm never comfortable, and I'm doing that right now, doing an American accent in an American production. I always feel, you know, not quite authentic, and I'm not. But the Northern Irish one, not many people know the Northern Irish or have heard that voice, but it's a very rich voice. And Michael Hirst, a New Zealand actor, gave me a really good tip for it. He said, you know, the thing about Northern Irish, it can be very, very harsh, but also it can be very, very tender. And I thought that's a wonderful thing to do. So it was a really rich voice to work with, and when you've got a character saying, "You're fucked," it's a new way of saying something. You say, "Well, not that often."
what other accents of over the years have you enjoyed having a bash at?
Oh, well. We did a film called Hunt for Red October, which we're all playing Russians on my particular submarine. Well, Sean Connery was the captain on. Well, Sean wasn't famous for his accents, so he'd call me Sham. There was a point when, you know, the sub that they built. We weren't on it that day, but it actually flipped over and sank. And so we missed drowning, unfortunately. I always think, you know, if Sean and I had been dumped in the sea, I just fancy Sean shouting at me, "Sham, shave yourself."
Well, speaking of accents, another accent that you had to do was quite a broad Australian accent.
No, well, they're both actually...
they're New Zealanders. New Zealanders, right.
And Meryl, of whom I'm very pond. That was another job that I mainly made in Melbourne. Meryl came in for a lot of flack for her accent.
I thought it was amazing. It was so hard to do an Australian accent.
Well, half New Zealand. It's a hybrid Australian accent. And people who hadn't really listened to to poor Lindy Chamberlain correctly were wrong. They said, oh, Meryl Streep's really good at accent, but she's shit at Australian, but she was actually fantastic.
She actually was. It's not the first time that you had worked with Meryl. You'd worked with her on Plenty as well.
Yeah. and by the time I was sort of overawed by her when we were doing Plenty. But we were very friendly by the time we did Evil Angels, and we were very close. I had to explain to other actors that Meryl's method, that at this point in her life anyway, was that if you're against her in the story, she wouldn't be friendly with you on set. It was just the sort of method that she had. Now, the problem with playing Lindy Chamberlain is absolutely everyone's not on your side. And people found that slightly off-putting. But
except for your character.
Except for my character.
Yes. Yeah. On his side.
But I told her the story that made her laugh. People have said there's quite a lot of in your book. There's quite a lot of animals having sex for some reason, and that wasn't deliberate. It's just I don't know. The animals seem to have sex when I'm around. Anyway,
Sam.
I'd just done a film in Adelaide, and I went up to an animal. What do you call it?
Sanctuary.
That's a sanctuary. That's right. And I'm walking through these wonderful enclosures, all that extraordinary Australian wildlife, and I walk around the corner, and to my surprise, there's a couple of kangaroos having sex.
Oh.
And there's a big bloke and a rather put upon, who is going, and she's got her ears back, and you can tell she's going, I wish this would just finish it. But the thing was, there was a crowd of other blokes, watching, and it's quite a compelling thing to I'm going, wow, I've never seen this before. And there, all these blokes are going, can we hurry this up? Because I'd like a go, So it's quite shocking. I didn't realise that kangaroos get up to this sort of thing. Anyway, this bloke's just enjoying himself, and he's not going to give way to anybody. And the other males are getting more and more restless, and then one jumps on the back of him. So there's three of them now. So the bloke in the middle is doing jumps, but I'm finding this quite disturbing, but fascinated by it. And then come around and call a whole phalanx of school children. And I still can't leave, because I think, how are the teachers going to cope with it? There's a kangaroo gangbang. How are they going to explain this to the children? So there was a general panic. But what are they? No. So I told that story to Meryl, and that sort of broke the ice.
Was it Meryl too? I mean, you've had a lot, been a leading man a lot, and had a lot of leading ladies, and it involves some love scenes, quite a few love scenes, I think, maybe you've done over the years.
Mm.
Very well done. Did Meryl say that you're the best kisser? Because if she did, that's a pretty good thing to have been said about you.
I'm not sure if she really meant it, but it was very nice. It was. I went to a talk like this at the Toronto Film Festival, and I was sitting about there, and they took questions from the audience, and one of the questions was, because they were very erudite questions, very, you know, brainy sort of audience. One of them said, who was the best kisser? she said, Sam Neill. So I blushed.
Here's another Sam Neill famous shot and film, the Jurassic Park series. Now, Steven Spielberg, I think he saw you in Dead Calm, is that right, with Nicole Kidman?
Yeah.
And what kind of character, when he was thinking of Dr. Alan Grant, what was he? What did he say to you that Alan was all about?
Yeah, I was sort of mystified by that. Again, I never really worked out why me. And I thought, I don't think I'm one of those sort of action-y type heroes. I'm not Schwarzenegger, and I'm certainly not Stallone. But I think, you know, really, and it made me feel better when I worked out what it was. Just an ordinary bloke, you know, having to run from extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah, exactly. And did you ever think, and I've stolen this from home, but that you would end up being an action hero doll? This is the Dr. Alan Grant, a prized possession of my son, who was extremely annoyed that I was taking it out of the house. I said, well, it is to see Sam today, Max. And he said, don't open the box. Because apparently the resale value is on these are very high. Yeah. He's never going to sell it, mind you. But that's a pretty amazing thing to have your own doll, Sam, I think.
Yeah, well, there's a few other ones that are sort of action ones. There's one with sort of very strange underpants.
Oh.
So that the legs work.
Again, that was when we talk about blockbuster films. You couldn't get bigger than that. And recently you went in 2020, I think it was, and you were reunited with your Jurassic buddies. You all lived in a big house somewhere, a big mansion near the studios.
Mm.
But it was COVID times, wasn't it? So you're quite restricted together.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm very fond of Laura and Jeff. We go back a long time and we survived Hurricane in 1993. It's 30 years since the first one. It just doesn't seem that long, but it's 30 years. So it's a long time to be friends.
Yeah.
And if you're going to be stuck in a hotel for 5 months, it might as well be with them because they're such good company. And Jeff and I would play music. He's a very accomplished pianist. Wonderful. And I'm a very bad ukulele player, so...
Well, that's debatable, and I'm on behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank you for getting us through COVID with your Instagram ukulele playing. Yes. It was made us very happy.
Yeah, the Instagram's been sort of fun, and it was weird not being able to see your friends. I mean, we all went through this extraordinary time, and we forget what it was like, but it was... Being so isolated from the people you love and so on was bizarre, wasn't it? But I thought we could make some little films. They can never be more than 2:20 because that's all the internet can take.
Yes, that's right. To
so
download.
I would, you know, bring up people like Hugo Weaving and Tim Spall and so on. So why don't we do a little bit? You just shoot yours on your iPhone and I'll shoot mine on my iPhone. And we'll do little scenes. And, they were fun.
They were great.
Yeah.
Get to this. Oh, yes, this is a bloke I know quite well. That is Rob Sitch.
Rob Sitch, the hirsute Rob Sitch.
I'm saying, well, maybe it's after he worked with Sam that Rob did decide to go hairless after that. Because we made a film called The Dish. And that's when we first really became close with Sam and met Sam. And we're all very keen for Sam to play a role, to play this lead in the film, along with the moon, I think would say, is the stars of the film.
Right.
It was about a moonwalk. And we thought, oh, gosh, we're going to have to really convince Sam to do this. And we had the script and Rob... went to your house and very most welcoming, invited him in.
Yeah, I well remember the I was expecting Rob, and I'd read the script, and I knew I wanted to do it. It was such a touching film, and you know, it ticked all sorts of boxes, and I thought, gosh, Rob's coming all the way from Melbourne to talk me into it, but I want to do it anyway. And anyway, he rang the bell, and I opened the door. There was Rob, and we shook hands. And I said, Rob, I want to do the film. He said, Sam, now, can I tell you why I think you might be interested in doing the film? I said, no, Rob, I want to do the film. An hour and a half later, he was still pitching the film. I was saying, do you want to come for tea? I do want to do the film, but the pitch went on and on and on. I think he'd learnt it by heart or something.
Oh, yes. I think we had role played the whole. I think I might have played you in the kitchen, saying, "Oh well, I'm not quite sure. I have been offered another, you know, blockbuster."
But it was such a fun film to do, and we've been.
Well, we shot it in Parkes for
Parkes, yeah,
which was wonderful. And now people go to Parkes to see The Dish. I think based on because they've seen the film. I think have you seen it? It was a great time. You brought your beautiful little dog as well.
My little Staffy kept me company during that film.
Because we were staying in sort of some... We took up all the accommodation in Parkes. We took over the entire township. Mm. And we had these little classic motel rooms. And we'd sort of go and visit each other and knock on the doors.
And this was before Parkes also became famous for the Elvis thing.
Yes, they... Yes, which is an unusual thing to have in Parkes. An Elvis sort of, is it like an exhibition or it's like a mini Graceland?
And all these Elvises come from all over the place.
It's like an Elvis convention there.
Yeah. But our little motel was opposite the Rock and Roll Wall of Fame, which honestly... is about...
it wasn't very big. The
it's as long as from here, from that guy there. And it had three names on it when we were there. It was Johnny O'Keefe.
Mm.
Can't remember who the other two were, but...
Yeah, no, Johnny O'Keefe.
And one of them was a newsreader.
Oh, that's right. Brian Henderson.
Brian Henderson, And the wall was about this high. They were supposed to replicate something at Graceland's, but the wall was this high. I don't think there's anything that high in Graceland.
Oh, that's right. I don't think so either. Well, this is an area of your life too, and I think it's not something that has just come out of thin air to all of a sudden take an interest in wines. Your involvement with wines is long been in your in the Neil family, and it was something that I guess that you always dreamed of being able to have a vineyard to start with. Let alone what you have now, what you've built this beautiful wine up to.
Yeah, well it wasn't really a dream. One of the things that people always say to their children now is, you follow your dreams. Well, I didn't have any dreams. I was a kid. I was a kid from a small town in Dunedin. But the dream became eventually. Mm. James Mason, although my family had been in wine and spirits for 150 years, I was staying with James Mason near Lausanne. And they took me out to dinner one night, and we sat in Charlie Chaplin's favorite restaurant, and which is an old auberge, about 600 years old or something. And there was Charlie Chaplin's name carved in the wood panel beside me. And James said, I think we should carve your name under there. I said, I couldn't possibly do that. Anyway, that night, he bought a wonderful bottle of wine, and I said, I've never drunk anything like this, James. What is this we're drinking? And he said, Burgundy, my boy, Burgundy. Don't forget it. And I never forgot it. And I got interested in Burgundy and Pinot Noir. And then, again, because, I had a bit of, from being someone extremely impoverished working for the New Zealand government, I had a movie career and I could sort of, I could afford the odd thing, and I built a house in Central Otago, in the mountains of my dreams. And then I was able to, it became apparent that Central Otago is a place where you could grow Pinot Noir, the greatest grape of all, successfully. And I thought, well, I'll do that too. And so I bought some land. We planted just a couple of acres. And the wine was extraordinarily much better than I'd imagined. Mm. And now that's become, that's 30 years ago as well. And that's become the other half of my life and has been immensely, made my life extremely rich. And I'm very proud of what we've done and what everything we do is sustainable. And our wine is organic. And I have lots of animals on my farm that I love, including a terribly ugly pig. who looks just like me, and
not quite.
No, we're both grumpy and old, and grey, and hairy. yeah, that's become the other dimension to my life, and that would never have happened unless all these accidents happened, which I sort of talk about in the book.
If anybody were, but, you know, to have James Mason be someone to introduce you to a wine is a wonderful memory, and that was an amazing time too, that he spotted that you had something and invited you with his wife.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's an amazing.
Yeah, that was another compliment. Job I was doing in Melbourne, a thing called Listen to Brayford at the ABC Studios. And, there were no mobile phones in those days, but somehow James tracked me down. He didn't know me, tracked me down, found out where I was working, and an assistant director came up to me. I was working with Wendy Hughes, and we finished the shot, and he said, "There's a phone call in the corner." I said, "What? Someone's calling me?" And who's calling me? I said, "Someone called James Mason." I said, what the James Mason? And I picked up the phone. And indeed, there was an unmistakable voice. And what he told me was that he and his wife, Clarissa, she was Australian, that they really thought I had something and that I needed to be working abroad. And he said, "I'm sending you an air ticket.
Good Lord.
And we want you to come and stay with us in Switzerland, and then go on to England. And I've got an agent I want you to be with."
You sure it wasn't one of your mates doing a voice?
I thought someone's pulling my leg, but anyway, it wasn't pulling my leg, and that's how I came to sort of have this international career.
Well, I have about a million other questions to ask you, but we have a full audience of people here, Sam, that will have questions as well. Are you up for answering some?
Yeah, absolutely, if anyone's got anything.
Has anybody got a question for Sam? If you pop your hand up, we've got microphones here. And otherwise, I'll be asking all my questions, but I'm sure you have. Oh, we have someone right in the very back row.
Someone's going to bring a microphone up to you, and
we got the first bit, which was "Hi, Sam."
Hi. it always takes. There's always a bit of tension, isn't there, before the microphone gets there.
Bit of pressure on now.
I don't know what's going to be asked.
I know.
Yeah. Apologies. It appears he's rather nervous to speak directly to you, Mr. Neil. And if I may say, as a young man back in 1993, seeing you in Jurassic Park. You're my childhood hero, so pleasure to meet you, I suppose. The question he asked you was your character Carl in Death in Brunswick. And where do you see him now if Carl was alive? Let's say he gave his mother that tea that he should have bloody gave her. And yeah, where do you see him? There's Laurie still bothering him and telling him to fuck off downstairs to make pizza for everybody, or?
Carl was something else. Hopefully he's still married to that gorgeous girl who thinks he looks like Sting.
He was slightly unslovenly. Is that a way to describe him?
Yeah, oddly enough, I have a daughter now who's living in Melbourne, and she calls herself something else because she's got a very interesting career, and she doesn't want people to think that she leverages me or something. I don't know what, but she's working in Brunswick. And she went out for a coffee the other day, and her friend said, "See that place over there? It used to be called the Bombay Rock, and that's where they shot a film called Death in Brunswick. You've probably never seen it, but it's a cult film. and it's got a bloke called Sam Neill in it. So and we love it here." And my daughter said, "Oh, that's interesting." Yeah, I don't know what's happened to Cal, but I don't think he ever became a chef of any distinction or anything like that.
Great question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, we have another question over here.
Can you tell us what the experience was like doing Hunt of the Wilder People with Taika Waititi?
Yeah, that's another, you know, there are two or three films that people are very sentimentally attached to: The Dish, Hunt for the Wilder People. Dean Spanley is another one that people seem to love irrationally. that was a really good shoot. We shot it we had no budget. We shot the whole thing in 4.5 weeks, ridiculous. And but we all were sort of had such commitment to it. And Taika is such a genius, you know. I would say to Taika all the time, "Taika, you know I'm not funny. If you want me to be funny, show me how to do it." But Julian, you know, who plays the kid in it, it was such a lot of fun. And I enjoyed every minute of it. I was slightly miffed at the end of it because people would come up and say, gee, that kid Julian in Hunt for the Wilder People, he really stole the film. And I said, come on, it's his film. I always say, I can't steal your own film.
people loved the story about that you were supposed to sing Happy Birthday at the table.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But not being able to get the rights for Happy Birthday.
Yes, that's true. And we were, you know, grumpy old hick and his lovely wife with this kid who's obviously been to terrible times. He's been in foster care and all sorts of things. And she's determined to celebrate his birthday. And hick is too. Hick doesn't really like singing or anything much. Anyway, we were rehearsing Happy Birthday to you, and suddenly the producer rushed in and said, "We can't use Happy Birthday to You. It's copyright, and we can't afford it." So we said, "What are we going to do?" And Rima Tiwiatu, who plays my wife in it, she said, "Well, we'll make up a song, and she can play." She played this little piano thing, and we, between Taika and Rima and myself, we made up that song in about 3 or 4 minutes. Ricky Birthday, Happy Birthday.
Ricky Baker.
Ricky Baker. It's
one of my favourite parts of the film, that song.
Yeah, you're isn't that amazing? With me, you're, and Hector. You've won the trifecta. it's much better than Happy Birthday.
It's much better than Happy Birthday. Any other questions we have? Yes, we have. Yes, oh, we can see you down here. Yes, we have microphones going to come down here for you.
Of all the film roles you've done, which one resonated with you personally the most and why?
Oh, that's... Look, I think I've got something out of every role I've played. And I'm always reluctant to pick a favourite because it sort of downgrades everyone, every other one. And there's been an awful lot of roles now. Some of them are richer than others. I'm playing a character right now that I think is really interesting. It's a Leanne Moriarty novel. I just thought I'd drop that in because it's a literary festival.
And can you name drop who you're starring with as well? You
yes,
know,
I'm
as well.
Opposite Annette.
Benning, Annette Benning.
I was just about to get it on, still was. it was delightful. But this character, who's one of those alpha males, about as far from me as you could possibly imagine, who's played tennis, you know, dominant tennis player all his life, it's about as far away from me as you could imagine. And people start to think his wife's gone missing, that he's murdered her. So it's a pretty complex
spoiler alert,
role.
Sam.
No, they start to think it pretty much right away. I'm not going to tell you whether I did it or not. But it's a pretty, it's a pretty interesting role. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, hi, Sam. Just wondering, will there be an opportunity to have a book writing session after this?
Yes, I've got all the information about that, that I'll let you know. That
at the end.
There will be a book signing afterwards.
Excellent, thank you.
I presume, Sam, yes. I haven't dobbed you in.
Yeah.
we've only got a few more minutes to go. Another question if we have. Thank you.
Hi, Sam. I just want to know what's next for the winery.
What's next for the winery, Sam?
Oh, what's next for the winery? Well, we've just, you know, it's just been vintage 2023 and it was a cracker. As far as plans go, it's more of the same. And now it's 30 years on. And with every successive year, we understand ourselves better. You know, every square meter of earth on those four vineyards, we have a more profound understanding, and the wine, I'm glad to say, gets better all the time. and they're fans.
We are big fans of Sam's wine. In fact, I was going to bring a bottle, but we drank it on Thursday night. I was going to share it and I thought, is it too early, 10:30 in the morning, to have a wine? But I thought, no, it's 12:30 in New Zealand. So that's what we say all the time anyway. Yeah. Everyone says things like that. On behalf of Sam, I'd like to thank everybody for coming out this morning. You've been really wonderful
thank you so much.
As well to have. And I want to let you know that Sam will be signing copies of his book. But I just have to give you a note that he won't be able to do photographs. Selfies and things like that, because otherwise he'd be here for about 7 hours, I think. So I'm sure you understand that reasoning why, but he'd be very happy to sign books for you. So please go up, and if you haven't got a copy, please go and get one. It's just a fabulous read. Sam Neill, did I ever tell you this? Congratulations, Sam.
Very proud. Thank you so much. Can I say that I'm so pleased that it's out now, in tandem with a book that I think is really wonderful, and I cannot recommend it more highly enough. My dear old friend Heather Mitchell has written another memoir, and she's here somewhere.
I can see Heather now. Congratulations, Heather.
And I cannot recommend... That's a real book. and uh, And I do recommend that you buy it. You'll love
it. Thank you very much, everybody, and enjoy the rest of your morning.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.